Hello, and welcome to the Gadget Show podcast, where tech gets a twist and the banter comes with extra batteries included. We're here to unravel the latest gadgets, debate the best tech, and maybe even settle a few age-old arguments about what is truly cutting edge. So grab your earbuds, settle in, and let's dive into the wonderful weird world of tech.
What a great intro, Susie. Yes, we're back for another episode. And for those watching, you might notice that we're not in our lovely Gadget Show podcast studio. Susie is out in Australia for the MotoGP. Looking good, Susie. Looks like it's a bit dark there. But thanks to the magic of tech, we're able to record this episode remotely.
Obviously, it's nighttime here in Australia and I am on the edge of a mountain. So communications are a little bit sketchy. So fingers crossed that we can get through this podcast. But I had a long flight over here and I tested my JBL earbuds, the Tour Pro 3s, and I've got them in. And honestly, they were brilliant on the plane. They completely blocked out everybody else, which much to my joy, because I can't stand listening to other people and noises, and got some good sleep. And yeah, so they're going well. So I thought I'd use them for today's pod as well.
Superb. So, yeah, and just to be clear, for those of you not watching, because I know lots of you listen to the podcast, Susie's actually wearing the earbuds right now. So they're being used to record her voice. And I'm guessing you're hearing my voice through the earbuds, which is great.
Yeah, 6 built-in microphones. So great for recording this podcast and even better for your phone calls, obviously. So moving on. So this week, we've got a bit of a different kind of podcast for you because it's been such a bumper week for tech news. So we thought we'd try and cover it all here for you. So including Tesla's new robo-taxis, the lowdown from Snapdragon's 2024 summit, the long-awaited colour Kindle e-reader, a new iPad mini and a brand new console. How about that?
Oh, God, it's almost like we're on some kind of exponential curve, Susie. By popular demand, we put together a list of some of the worst gadgets for our wall of shame. And to help us decide which one truly deserves a spot on the wall, we've got a very special guest joining us.
First of all, though, some comments and questions from you lovely lot. First of all, Simon Ryland, who's one of our Patreons. Do you still find yourself choosing gadgets for their continuity with other hardware stroke software rather than their overall performance? One for you, Jace.
I think that's a really good question, Simon. What I think you're referring to is what we call the walled garden approach, which Apple are very, very much invested in, rather than the more open approach that, say, Android devices have. So what we mean is you buy, you know, an iPhone and it has functionality with a MacBook that makes the workflow between those two devices quite compelling in an attempt to keep you within that ecosystem and basically get your money. If that's what you mean, then I'm not subscribed to any one particular system. I like it when things are compatible, and I'm also utterly frustrated on an almost daily basis by the fact that I might shoot something on my iPhone, like a voice recording the other day. I did a voice recording. I wanted to use it in a video. And then I had to get some weird software from the internet to convert the Apple format of the voice note that I'd taken to be able to use it on my, you know, Microsoft Windows-based computer. And it just annoys me. So I almost out of spite push away this notion of what you've called choosing gadgets for their continuity with other hardware. Does that, hopefully that's what you meant, Simon, and that's my honest answer.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm probably the opposite of Jason because I cannot be bothered and I just like the ease of use. So I fall into the opposite side of that.
One from Nick James on Facebook. Which is the best home projector that is a good quality but doesn't break the bank?
They are expensive, aren't they? Can I suggest the Samsung Freestyle, the second generation, just because of its ease of use for setting it up? So it flips 180 degrees. And you can have a 30-inch screen up to 100-inch, so you can go TV size to, you know, floor to ceiling. 360-degree sound, and I think it's just a really lovely thing. It's slightly bigger than a chunky can, and does a great job. One from Daniel Robert Burkhout, who says, "I hope that you still got Otis along with you." Well, Daniel, stay tuned.
So, shall we talk tech news, Susie? So Tesla revealed the much anticipated robo-taxi, referred to as the Cyber Cab. And it was a presentation, interestingly, on a film set, Warner Brothers Studios. So that's interesting, Suze. The demonstrations of various people being carried around by the, you know, rather impressive looking sort of gold Cyber Cab. You have to put it into context. What would it be like, you know, on the chaotic actual streets of, you know, LA or New York or wherever?
I was interested in the look of it, in the design, if you like. So it was a two-seater bit, which was interesting. Doesn't have a steering wheel or pedals. Butterfly wing doors that open to allow you in. No rear window, but a big boot for lots of packing. So that would be good for me. But actually, what interested me as well was the fact that the share price dropped massively when this car was announced. And I find that quite interesting, Jace.
Yeah, no. Yeah, the market is often an indicator of what people truly think. Because obviously when you're investing hundreds of millions, you know, you've got to be honest and truthful about what you know, about the what people are really feeling. I felt it looked a bit like a kind of hybrid between a Model 3 and a Cybertruck. I quite like the look of it, actually. And of course, Susie, they also showcased the Robo Van. Now, this, I think, it was the less covered of the revelations they had. And we'll get to the Optimus robot in a minute. But I thought it was possibly one of the most significant devices, because I forget the capacity of it. Was it 10 people it can carry? It was relatively big. And in terms of, you know, something looking like, you know, it was off the set of a science fiction movie, this is it. You can't even see the wheels. And the idea that, you know, it would almost be a service vehicle, this RoboVan, being able to drive itself with a robot inside that gets out and changes the wheels or, you know, reconfigures the navigation module within, you know, one of the cyber cabs. That seems like a really useful scenario. You know, it's almost the vehicle that we need, the RoboVan, whereas the cyber cab feels less necessary. I don't know what you think.
I'm just not really a fan of, FSD, full self-driving. I like driving, so I don't really want a vehicle to drive me around without a driver in it. But I'm just stuck in the dark ages, I suppose. But I still have a massive question mark over it, you know, in terms of safety. And I don't feel fully convinced that we're ready for yet. And this cyber cab is expected, well, it's first of all expected to be about $30,000. And the production slated to start 2026-27, which I feel like it's just not ready. We're not ready for it. I had this conversation when I was doing some work with Hyundai, and it seems still to be quite futuristic. But you know, here we are with it being launched.
What I want to just spend some time on, are the robots, because, and not for the reason that you might think. I want to ask a serious question. For those people who have already seen it, then fine, you'll get what I'm talking about, the Optimus robot demonstration at the same launch. If you haven't, you must look at some clips on YouTube. And the question I want to pose is, were these robots acting 100% autonomously? And what I'm referring to, the movement, which certainly part of the movement unquestionably was being activated by the robot itself, because it would go to a reset position. I'm showing you on the camera, if you're watching, a kind of reset, and then it would do these dance movements, which were very elegant, very sort of Japanese geisha in kind of style, very funny, lots of kind of konnichiwa style kind of waving at camera. The movement was certainly without question, a large proportion of that movement was the robot itself. I would question whether at certain points it was being manipulated wirelessly by someone in, you know, a pair of gloves. But I don't know. I'm less bothered about that. What I'm getting at is the voice. Now, I've watched this, geek that I am. I've drilled this down, Susie. I've watched the interactions with the robots, the conversations. And as someone that uses AI on an almost daily basis, and it responds to me a little bit like the Optimus robot does, except the Optimus robot is so much more natural and so much more human-like, I suspect, and I'm not, allegedly, that I'm not sure that was Grok, Elon Musk's much-vaunted AI platform. I don't know. What a, I'd be interested to know in the comments what you think.
Are you suggesting there's a Wizard of Oz?
I am. I'm raising the question, Susie, and I think that was a really good way to put it. All right, well, let us know in chat what your thoughts are. Fascinating, this one. Really interested to read your comments. And by the way, we always read your comments, don't we, Susie?
We certainly do. From the Tesla RoboCab to the Amazon new ColourSoft, which is the first colour Kindle. Amazon's got a whole new lineup of devices that they just launched, but we're interested in the colour Kindle. And obviously the Kindle came out 17 years ago, Jace, which seems extraordinary. And what seems even more extraordinary is it's taken them so long to bring one out in colour. And I do wonder perhaps whether it got kind of shelved during the COVID time and now feels like the right time for them, maybe with new markets of graphic novels and comic readers and such like. But it is interesting, and there's been a lot of excitement about it being colour. And I think it, you know, could be a real game changer for them with these new markets. So the Kindle ColourSoft, as it's called, it brings everything that we're used to with the Kindle. So the fast, you know, page turning, the high contrast and auto-adjusting front light and the fantastic battery, but with added colour. And they've tried to create like a paper feel, as they do, with the colour. And they've got two styles to choose from. So you can go with a standard or a more vibrant colour. The display is quite interesting. It's built on an oxide backplane, so it's got really sharp contrast and much better image definition. And actually, it turns the pages faster. In terms of the colour, it doesn't do what others do with the e-ink gallery 3 tech, which is what you've got in your printer. You know, you've got your four printer cartridges with your cyan, your magenta, your yellow and your white. They've got a kind of what they call it, a colour custom display stack, which sounds a bit like some kind of magic to me that we'll never know the science behind it. But that's what they're using it. But effectively, you know, it gives that vibrancy and that higher contrast when you're reading compared to the other e-readers that are out there. They've got enhanced illumination. It's supposed to be 25% brighter than previous, more LEDs, obviously, more and more even light distribution. Wireless charging and 8 weeks of battery life, which we're used to with the ordinary Kindle. And it's waterproof, so you can have a bath with it and you can go on the beach and not worry about it getting wet.
The idea that I could take, you know, a whole library of graphic novels on an extended trip, you know, with me really appeals. 32 gigs is enough, isn't it, to get loads of graphic novels on there. I only question how truly good the color performance is, because in some of the reviews that I've looked at, and I've not been lucky enough to have one in my hand, so just put that in context, I just wonder what the color reproduction is like, Susie. How deep the colors, how good the contrast is, you know. They're good, aren't they, though, at making a device that's easy on the eyes, easy on the pocket, relatively speaking, compared to tablets. And also that battery life, you can't argue with that, can you? My God, what was it 8 weeks?
8 weeks. That's a long holiday. I'm hoping that because they've waited so long that they've got it right. And they do say, like, when you zoom in, you don't have to worry about it being pixelated. So, for example, if you're, I don't know, reading a recipe, you want to see the picture. I always want to see the picture of what the food's supposed to look like. And I want to zoom in and be able to really make it make me hungry and make me want to make that dish, you know. So I hope they have got it right. I have not had one in my hand because obviously I've been traveling and I'm in Australia at the moment.
I think we should get one into the studio, and that you should go off on one of your travels and give us a thorough report. I think it would be a really interesting one to look at.
Yeah, I want color when I'm reading. I want to see the pictures, I want to see the photographs, I want to zoom in. And you know, for me, this is quite exciting, so I can't wait to get my hands on one. And just to dot the I's and cross the T's, it's on the market for $279. So I'm assuming that's pretty much parity with sterling at the moment. And it comes out on October the 30th.
I've got one for you now, Susie. And it comes from one of my sort of favourite niche manufacturers, Qualcomm, who are behind the Snapdragon chipsets. And the reason I love them is because they are often the chipset of choice for virtual reality, mixed reality, augmented reality headsets. You know, without what Snapdragon have done over the last 10 years, really virtual reality wouldn't be where it is. So when they announce something that they say is pretty game changing, I instantly pay attention. And what they unveiled, I think it was, well, at the time of recording yesterday, the Snapdragon 8, I think they call it the Elite, which they're saying is the world's fastest mobile CPU. But look, that's not why it's newsworthy. It's newsworthy because the platform powers a new era of on-device generative AI, wouldn't you believe, built to handle the complexities of multimodal AI seamlessly without, Susie, listen to this, without, it says here, without prioritizing privacy. Don't know how they're going to honor that claim, but anyway. So, you know, Samsung, Meta, Asus, a load of these brands use Snapdragon to power their devices. And obviously what they're trying to do is, well, not just match, but exceed what Apple are trying to do with the new
with
category.
With the A18.
Yeah, the A18, with the AI on chip category, which is what Intel are talking about. It's what Microsoft are talking about. The notion is, Suze, that as we connect to you in Australia, right, you've got all the gear, haven't you? But you don't have bandwidth, and that's why you're going to have to wait to upload the recordings that you've done, and that's why the image that I'm receiving from you, I'll tell you, listeners and viewers, while we're recording this, is not a great image. It's a bit pixelated, right, because of the bandwidth issues we've got, right? Well, that's the same with AI. Whenever you connect to a cloud-based distributed cloud service to compute all your AI questions and requests, you're vulnerable to the bandwidth limits, right? So when you put AI on chip, you're no longer vulnerable. You don't get that same massive distributed group of computers to work on your problem, but what you do get in this case is the new Snapdragon hardware, or in Apple's case, as you said, Susie, the A18. So that's the category that they're launching into, and they've made a big sort of point about the fact that it's a competitor to Apple's A18, and they really want to try and steal some of their thunder. I think it's exciting. It's a bit geeky, but it's exciting.
Jace, can we just have a little chat about the iPad Mini 7 that was announced last week, which is obviously coming into line for the non-stop Apple intelligence. Interestingly, it's got the A17 Pro chip, not the A18, but will obviously increase performance there with speed, better graphics, etc. In terms of storage, 128 gig, which is double that of the last model. And it also comes in a 256 gig and a 512 gig configuration. What are your thoughts on the fact that they're quickly getting into line with AI?
Well, obviously, the iPad Mini crew have been waiting for a significant upgrade, I think, since 2021. So it's about time. I think, you know, if you're an iPad Mini user, You love it. You know what I mean? It's one of those niche areas. You know what I mean? Like, people are really enthusiastic about. And I get it, because it gives you the sort of functionality of an iPad Pro or an 11-inch iPad, whatever, in a smaller form factor, which, as you know, as the world's most traveled woman, can have real advantages if you're out and about. But again, they're pushing Apple Intelligence, and they're pushing it on the A17 Pro platform, not the A18 or A18 Pro. So bit of a damp squib, really, for me, if I'm absolutely honest.
So it's just been released, £499 for the Wi-Fi model and £649 for the Wi-Fi and the cellular version. And I know I have to say this because iPad users always want to know about the colours. So it comes in four different colours: blue, purple, starlight and space grey. Right, that's it then for the news. Coming up, somebody very, very special. Right, we've had a few requests for this, okay? Welcome to the Gadget Show podcast, brand new feature, the Wall of Shame. Now, this is where we take a look at, tech and gadgets that didn't quite get off the mark. I mean, there's been a few, hasn't there? Whether they've overpromised, underdelivered, or were just downright wrong. And to help us decide which gadget deserves a spot on the wall, we've got none other than the legend that is Otis Dealey.
How are you guys doing?
Yeah, good. Better for seeing you. Thank you so much. What have you been up to? What have you been up to since we last saw you on this here podcast?
I had a most epic summer, but that's a personal thing. Let's talk about work. Currently recording a brand new series of Shop Smart, Save Money, which will be on your telly boxes, or is on your telly boxes, Wednesdays, Channel 5, 7 o'clock. Eh? Figure out how to spend your cash properly.
Right. I love you both very much, but because I'm in Australia, it's night time. So shall we move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. Right. Shall we start with the Microsoft Zune?
Oh, good choice, Susie. The Zune. Yeah, why it flopped. I mean, it flopped, didn't it?
Well, yeah, because obviously it was going to try and take on the iPod, wasn't it? And it just came in a bit too late. It was chunky, clunky software, lack of distinguishing features, I would say, and had a really awkward marketing campaign. So despite some loyal fans, it could not compete with Apple's dominance, could it?
The one redeeming feature that I remember about the Zune is more recent, in that, do you remember it made an appearance in one of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies? Do you remember that?
Yes, it did. It did. And I mean, you say redeeming. I mean, that still doesn't mean that the device was any good. I mean, it's now in sort of Marvel MCU folklore.
Yeah.
But it was still, it just couldn't compete, could it, really? I mean, the iPod was already dominating by this point.
Something interesting that I'm reading in my notes, which I'm going to be honest, I wasn't aware of, but this is very cool, that the last wave of Zunes, the sort of the most recent software update, which I think was in 2008, brought with it games. You could play Hexic and Texas Hold'em, as well as the function to enjoy audiobooks on it. That's quite interesting, isn't it? They were obviously looking to kind of, I don't know, appeal to the kind of Xboxer in all of us.
Here's my second suggestion then. Google Glass, which you know I was not a fan, 2013 they came out. I cannot believe that was more than 10 years ago. That is crazy.
Isn't that nuts?
Did you try the Motus at the time? Because we had them on the Gadget Show for a few weeks in the office.
No, I didn't get to try them. But I don't know if this should feature. I mean, yes, they tanked as a product, but I fully believe we weren't ready for them. They were ahead of their time. I mean, if you look at the bunch of releases we've got now, you know, Jason, earlier on off pod, you mentioned Orion. We've had the pair from Ray-Ban. Snapchat had a pair as well.
They're really invested in it, aren't they, Snapchat?
Yeah, they really want it to happen. And I know you're passionate about mobile phone devices just not being a great idea. You want to integrate your technology.
Yeah, that's one of my key themes. Yeah,
with your reality.
I feel foolish holding an Egyptian tablet next to my face.
Yeah, I think they were ahead of their time, and I would argue they don't belong on the Wall of Shame.
Okay, I would argue they do belong on the Wall of Shame, but I really love the fact that you've gone with a different, an unexpected angle on that. And I'll tell you why. I mean, because I use them.
Yes.
I remember walking around Digbeth in Birmingham, which for those people listening and watching is where the Gadget Show podcast is currently filmed. And it's where all the episodes of the Gadget Show proper with us lot in it was filmed. And it's a really cool sort of urban industrial area. It's actually where Peaky Blinders, the real Peaky Blinders and the TV series is filmed. So you'll get that sort of vibe. So walking around those streets with this device on my face, I can only say it was something akin to, if you opened your letterbox, right, and then you stuffed in some tracing paper, right, and then someone came into your driveway and you had to identify them by kneeling down, looking through the letterbox, through the tracing paper, you'd see that there's someone there. I mean, it's maybe a bit better than that. And it had some sort of navigational functionality that I can remember. The field of view is the thing that was the main issue. And that's also the issue on other augmented reality devices or mixed reality devices like HoloLens from Microsoft. This has always been a thing. And that's why, I've actually got it here, actually. I've got one of my many VR helmets right in front of me. I'm holding it up for those people listening, the Quest 3. And with the cameras on the front there, look, and you can see if you're watching, those are the pass-through cameras. They give me a field of view that is wide enough for me to be fully immersed and to forget about the borders, like the end of the cinema screen. And that's not what Google Glass did, is it, Suze?
No, I mean, I think, you know, you've explained it pretty well there in the comedy style, but they were very expensive. There was a massive privacy issue with them, but obviously they weren't ever on the market. They didn't go to market. They weren't a commercial product. they didn't quite get there. They realised that they were, you know, as you said, oh, ahead of the time.
Anyway, I'm sure we've got some other wall of shamers.
What about from 1993, going right back there, the Apple Newton, the personal digital assistant, which was, you know, pretty revolutionary in concept, but was hampered, obviously, by poor handwriting recognition and a high price, which seems to be something that we're talking about a lot. And it got mocked at the time and became a symbol of early tech failures, really, before it got discontinued 3 years later. What about that?
Oh, hey, Otis. So you were a member of the CBBC crew, weren't you? I'm right
yes,
on it.
Yes, I was. CBBC,
and,
yeah.
So in an early part of my career, I know you know this, Otis, but maybe Susie, you're not so familiar with this. I actually worked for Children's BBC, and I was a trainee producer for the BBC for like 2 years, and I worked on Live and Kicking. And what I tried to do as this sort of like, you know, super keen junior researcher was bring more video games and more gadgets onto, you know, BBC Saturday Morning TV, Kids TV. And I remember I had this sort of battle with the editor where I'd always be saying, we need more video games. And I got the Apple Newton onto that show, and it was on Live and Kicking.
Oh, wow.
And the only reason I did it was so I could get one. I could say, hi, I'm from the BBC. Can you send me an Apple Newton, please? and so I played with it and spent you know, a few weeks before I had to send it back fiddling around with it. And I always liked it. I tell you what was interesting. The big selling point for the Apple Newton was its handwriting recognition, which even, as you know, even today is a bit of a thing. Like, it, as in, it doesn't really work brilliantly. Although, forgive me, if someone listening or watching realizes there is a great natural handwriting recognition software solution out there that I've not come across, then fair enough. It's not an area of my expertise. But I know that for many years it's been difficult. They tried it, and it wasn't terrible. You had to sort of...
It was terrible.
Oh, was it?
Come
okay,
on.
Go...
That's one of the reasons why it failed, because the handwriting recognition was so bad. I mean, you know, you're basically speaking other languages with it without realizing, and they're all made up.
Well, I was going to complete that statement. I wasn't going to just leave it there. I was going to say it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't great. That's the point I was trying to make. And I remember, a bit like the Palm Pilot, as I seem to remember, you had to, you couldn't just write in your own handwriting. You had a combination of that and certain types of ways of doing letters, you know, that were easier for it to understand. And then you got a kind of relatively okay input, you know, interface, if that makes sense.
I don't know if you guys remember another nail in the coffin of the device was its inclusion in an episode of The Simpsons. Two of Bart's bullies typed into or wrote on their Newton device, and it translated it to Eat Up Martha. I mean, if something fails on The Simpsons or it's ridiculed on The Simpsons, then that's it.
It's finished. Yeah, you're finished. that's really, no, it's true. I do remember, but I remember struggling with it, and I think maybe I wanted the handwriting input to be better than it was, because my kind of early adopter gene is so prominent that I sometimes, you know, I still feel it now, like with say augmented reality glasses that are being touted, I kind of will them to work. But you're right, Susie, it wasn't great. All I mean is it wasn't as bad as everyone makes out. You could learn the ways of the device.
Sometimes, Jace, I think that your AR glasses are rose tinted.
Yeah, nice.
He's got rose tinted AR glasses.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that too.
Right, your next one then, Nokia N-Gage 2003. What do you reckon?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it.
Right, what did you love about it? Because the device, there was just too much going on. How did you even decipher what you were meant to be doing?
Like,
the design's awful. Trying to play on my N-Gage.
No, look, so that people listening, watching, understand, in case you're not OG, and you, or you are OG, but you never had one. The answer to your question is that it was in a different format to every other phone, virtually, apart from the communicator. It was, let's say landscape as opposed to portrait in orientation. And it felt like holding a, okay, to be fair to you, Otis, relatively complex overly buttoned game controller. So for me, I had a gamepad in my pocket rather than a phone. And it looked cool. It had that kind of, well, mine was a kind of gunmetal grey, you know, with a kind of like faux carbon fibre vibe going on.
That's the classic model.
And I think you, didn't you slot in little cartridges into it?
It was a multimedia card, wasn't it?
Right, okay, yeah. So you bought, but you bought the games, didn't you? That was the thing. And I was, you know, buying games from a phone, and it was like, well, it was having a pocket-sized kind of Game Boy, or a bit more like a Game Gear, actually, more like the Sega Game Gear, wasn't it? But it was miniature, and you could literally fit it in your back pocket. The thing that we need to remember, folks, is that phones back then were smaller than phones are now. I thought it was beautiful. I'd get one now. I tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to get that, and I'd also like to get the banana phone. You remember the banana phone from Nokia?
Banana phone all day.
Yeah, and I'd like some cool, you know, sort of hardware engineer to hack it so that I could have a modern Android operating system on it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But in the case of the old school N-Gage, or in that case, banana phone, that would be a brilliant thing.
I think it's fair to say some of those product designers at Nokia really did have an eye on the future. And, you know, it's not the only device. You mentioned the banana phone. There are a couple of other handsets that had a very different design to what was common among smartphones. I salute them for that, definitely.
But it's on the wall of shame, Susie, so my enthusiasm is obviously misplaced.
Well, you know, it had a very poor library of games, so that's why it's on the wall of shame, really. And it had to hold it sideways, and it was a bit awkward. So there it is. And don't forget, you looked absolutely bloody ridiculous making a phone call. No, you
never
did.
Bothered me.
It was called a taco for a while. You like walking around with a taco, which I don't put past you.
Yeah, fair cop.
Okay, and I want to do this one quite quickly, and I think we can, because it's really obvious. And I'm just suggesting the segue, because it just looks so flipping ridiculous.
I mean, it was plagued by human catastrophe, wasn't it? What's the world record for the longest time anyone has stayed on a Segway? It's probably like 15 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, Otis, I agree. I seriously injured my knee on a Segway and almost dislocated my knee.
Full disclosure, or confession here, I've never been on one. They never looked right. I know I'm going to be cast out from the tech familiar, but I couldn't invest... I just couldn't risk my corporeal safety by jumping on one of those things.
Yes, but from the Segway experiment came
so
many great, accelerometer, based transport solutions.
Agreed. The one wheel.
Like the one wheel, exactly, which we've featured on this podcast. Anyway, what's the final wall of shame, Susie?
Okay, we're going back to the mid-70s. Are you ready? Sony Betamax. 1975,
argument. No, take it off. No argument. It does not belong on the wall of shame. No, 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 no.
Expand, I'm really interested.
Okay, so it lost the PR campaign because Sony's Betamax went up against the VHS. But my dad, this is the only time my dad has ever been an early adopter of technology. He bought a Sony Betamax VCR, so video cassette recorder. It recorded in great quality. It played in great quality. The problem with being an early adopter of the Sony Betamax was that format lost the war. VHS won. It was cheaper, more readily available, easier to produce. And so the VHS ran off with the market. That killed the Sony Betamax as a commercial entity, as a commercial device. But behind the scenes, the Betamax was the format of choice for making television programs, for recording and editing. All of that stuff was recorded onto a Betamax tape. I've got hundreds of them in the room next door with my show reels on, with clips of...
I don't want to wind you up, mate, but...
Everything. Is that on Betamax? Right. I'll take it. I'll take it off
No, sorry, mate. And this one also, on VHS, my friend. By the way,
VHS.
Listening, I just held up Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Terminator on VHS.
Classic. VHS did win the war. Betamax was the superior quality. In technology, sometimes superior quality does not always win the day. So now is the time to choose the gadget for our wall of shame. And Otis, as you are our very special guest, It's on you.
Okay, well, let me say this. All bar one of the devices we've discussed have had at least one person pitching for it in terms of trying to save it from going on the wall. Impassioned pleas of some of the positivities that these devices brought. And there was one device that unanimously, from the three of us, absolutely flopped the show. Like, without question, deserves its place on the wall of shame, because there are no upsides, there are no positives, apart from the fact that, you know, it led the way for some of the more sophisticated personal forms of transport that we have now. It's the Segway, man. The Segway goes up. It goes up on the wall, a deserved place on the wall of shame.
That's the only time I'm ever going to applaud the Segway.
I think that's a fair result.
Well, thank you, Otis, for putting our first gadget on the wall of shame. We could not think of anybody better. You did a fine job, my friend, and it's gorgeous to see you.
Thank you very much. Absolute pleasure, as always. Just one favour, you two. The next time we do this, can we do it in a nice sort of huggable, snuggable space together?
Yeah, the Gadget Show podcast studio. How about that?
Rather than you down in Cornwall, you down
and me
under.
Down under.
Yeah, and me in my IKEA office.
See you, mate. Good to see you.
<I know. laughs> Love you guys.
So, Jace, for our gadget of interest this week, I've got something to tell you about that I know that you're going to adore and also know lots about. So the Analog 3D is an upcoming gaming console designed to play original Nintendo 64 N64 cartridges without relying on software emulation. It aims to provide 100% compatibility with N64 games from all regions, allowing users to enjoy their classic titles with modern enhancements.
I'm more excited than it's healthy for a man of my age to be. I want everyone to understand that when I saw this on the sheet that was sent around a few days ago about this episode of the pod, that I was filled with glee. And the reason is Analog 3D is like the Apple of the retro gaming scene. They are a design-centered group of people that are a kind of money no object. Let's make something truly remarkable. Let's spend years evolving it. They've made the Mega SG, which is a beautiful brand new version of the Mega Drive that you can plug Mega Drive cartridges into, and you get all kinds of really interesting benefits, which I'm going to get into in a minute, so I won't do it. They've also done the Super Nintendo, they call it the Super NT. They've done a Pocket, which is their version of a Game Boy. They're relatively pricey, but what they offer you is your actual gaming catalog at levels of resolution and clarity that were unimaginable in the 80s and 90s. And so we come to the Analog 3D, which is a strange name, because what it is it's their version of what I'm holding, for those of you watching this pod right now, which is the beautiful Nintendo 64. This is my version. I've played thousands of hours on that. I play games like this that I'm holding in my hand, Perfect Dark. GoldenEye is one of my other favourites. All of you will be familiar with how groundbreaking both these titles were. And with the brand new Analog 3D, you simply plug your cartridge in, as I'm doing now, click it in, and what it then does is it upscales it and it makes it look beautiful. It'll output it as 4K, Susie, on HDMI rather than whatever goddamn connection I need to get that thing working. It'll support NTSC and PAL. You get lag-free, zero degradation. You also get, and this is really cool, and I brought a model to show you, very faithful emulation of both CRT, so cathode ray tube TVs, and PVMs, personal video monitors. I'm holding one up. This is a tiny, tiny one. And these are the sort of things that you're more familiar with, Susie, I'm guessing you, in outside broadcast vans, because that's what they
absolutely
hail from. Yeah, and they're kind of laboratory grade televisions, and so you can emulate those displays out the back of this new analog 3D N64 device, where you can only use real cartridges, so you can't, it's not emulation, as you said in your intro, and that's really important. It's a really important point to make. So it's a real oddity. It's a thing of beauty, not that expensive, very, very affordable for something that really is, you know, the absolute pinnacle. It's the Aston Martin of retro gaming devices.
It's a lovely nostalgic nod to classic gaming, isn't it? And it comes in at a price of $249.99. It'll be released early next year, and pre-orders have already started.
And that's a wrap, ladies and gentlemen, for this week's Gadget Show podcast. Big thanks to my compadre, Susie, for joining us all the way from down under. Well done, Suze, proving that even across the globe, tech can keep us together.
And a big shout out, of course, to our partners, JBL, for making this episode possible and for creating these amazing Core Pro 3 earbuds, which I shall be wearing on my flight on the way home for the brilliant active noise cancellation.
Oh, yeah, blocking out those kids sat next to you or behind you.
All the kids, all the people, actually, not just kids, blocking out everybody whilst listening to my favourite podcast.
Yeah, so hit the link in the description to get yourself a pair. And safe flight home, Susie. Looking forward to seeing you soon in the Gadget Show podcast studio.
Oh, yeah, thank you so much. Looking forward to being back as well. Remember, though, to subscribe, leave us a review, stay tuned for more tech talk wherever in the world we might be. And we'll catch you next time. Thank you for watching or listening.
See you later, mates.
G'day.
The Gadget Show podcast with Jason and Susie was presented by Jason Bradbury and Susie Perry off the telly. It was produced by Ewan Keel and Tom Clint and is a North One production.